Hello and welcome to another episode of the Dan Assor Show, supported by show community patrons, TF Connect, Tarsus Group, 19 Group, SISO, and Smart Digital. This week I spoke with Jim McGinty, MD Western Europe, Middle East, Turkey, and Africa Foundry, formerly IDG Communications, a company that sits at the intersection of media and marketing to drive technology adoption all around the world. Foundry run a diverse mix of events for high-quality technology audiences, ranging from intimate round tables to large conferences and awards. This episode, Jim talked to me about his career, the company changing name to Foundry and what it meant for its customers, how to keep up with trends in technology, the event landscape post-pandemic, the value of brands when serving a community, industry recruitment, and also his desert islet picks. Check out all my content on danassor.com and be notified first about new episodes by subscribing to my YouTube channel and following me on Apple Podcasts and Spotify platforms. So hello and welcome to the show, Jim McGinty. How are you doing today, Jim?
Hi Dan, I'm very good, thanks. Very good.
I wasn't sure if I was going to trip up on your surname.
It's
Did
Many
I say
people
it all
do.
right? I said
Yeah,
it all right.
you did indeed. Yeah, thank you.
What is the origin of McGinty? Let's start there.
Well, I believe the Mc prefix denotes son of, and
Oh, yeah.
I think the name comes from Donegal. I think it's up the top of Ireland.
Oh.
I could be wrong on that. I could be wrong on that. Yeah.
I didn't know actually that the muck bits there's for son of. I should know that
Yeah.
already. There you go.
This
So
is where it comes from. I should have said my dad, shouldn't I? That would be
yeah. It's a whole different podcast. We won't get into that. Listen,
Yeah.
Jim, thanks for joining me on the show today.
Pleasure.
Real pleasure to have you. And we're going to get into all sorts of different bits and pieces. But before we start off with, can you sort of bring to life your role as MD of Foundry of Western Europe and Meta? And we're getting to talk about what Meta means for those that aren't aware. But yeah, just bring to life the business and your role within it, please.
Yeah, sure. So yeah, I'm Managing Director of Foundry in Western Europe, Middle East, Turkey, and Africa. So Foundry was up until this year actually known as IDG Communications, which was the leading media data and services company for the technology industry, and actually since the 1960s, which in itself is fairly mind-blowing. But
Yeah.
now as Foundry, we're on quite an advanced transformation. I know we'll dig into this a bit more in the conversation today, but we're on quite an advanced transformation from that media network background to much more of a kind of integrated marketing technology and data provider type company. So it's actually quite an exciting time redefining that company. I'm based in the UK.
Yeah.
That's certainly the prime sort of focus of operations in my region, but we also cover Benelux. We have offices in Dubai, as well as licensees around the region as well. So it's a wide region, and across that we look after B2B and B2C audiences. Our prime sort of customers are CMOs and increasingly CROs, chief revenue officers and chief
Okay.
marketing officers in the technology industry.
Cool. Thank you so much for that intro. It's always useful. And we're going to talk more about what's in a name change, the change from
Yeah.
IDG to Foundry in just a minute. So let's just talk about your career. Sounds like an interview. Sort of
Yes.
is. There's
Well,
no job. There's no job at the end of it, but you're coming up for, I think, 8 years at
Yeah.
what is now Foundry. And before that, you were 7 years at Incisive.
Yes. Yeah.
So you've seen quite a bit over the last 15 years and a lot of changes. We were talking about in our sort of pre-chat, the rise of social media. I remember my first job, which was at an ad agency in the sort of mid-90s. We were just about using email,
Yeah.
never mind social media for campaigns and just generally in our lives. And obviously, we've gone through a pandemic. How have you sort of dealt with, I guess, in a personal and a professional capacity, the sort of changes, maybe first off around tech, in the industries that you work within?
Yeah, I mean, I think when I look back over my career, I mean, actually it started about 25 years ago. In fact, 25 years next month, I've been in this industry, which of course has changed
Sure.
seismically over that time. And for me, the pivotal sort of part of that has been spent in the tech industry, which I think is quite often at the forefront of a lot of these changes on the media side as
Yeah.
well. And of course, over the last 10 years or so, there've been some really massive changes in, I think, our our industry. Big ones, obvious ones, I would say, is the growth of online platforms and aggregators, social media, of course, new ways that people are interacting and communicating. But I think the biggest change, you can boil it down to one word, is really one of measurability. Yeah, everything now is so much more accountable. How you use and grow data really defines how successful your company will be now. And I just don't think there are tactics or channels or brands anymore that live in that rarefied air where they don't have to demonstrate some sort of return on investment. And that's a good thing. I think everybody's sharpened up, and those who haven't have kind of fallen by the wayside. So for me, a big part of navigating that those sort of waters has been around understanding the value that my company or products, wherever that may have been over that time, what the value is that they add for our customers. And
yeah,
that's been a real underlying driving force to what's happening at Foundry as well.
Yeah. And how do you as an individual sort of, because obviously your role evolves, the business evolves, hopefully the two evolve together. You know, for people listening, how have you sort of kept abreast of all the changes that have been happening in the industry that you work within?
Yeah, I think there's probably a whole extra podcast series that you could do on how to manage one's career, and I'm not 100% sure I'm to host that or be on that. But I think when you think about how to sort of navigate those waters and how to stay current, obviously there's a wealth of factors that motivate people just beyond the obvious of getting paid. You know, dictate what people want and how they what they want from a role. But for me, I've always sort of thrived in a situation where I have a very real sense of what my mission is, what's expected of me. So I think that I've been quite fortunate in the companies I've worked in have been fairly forward thinking, quite innovative companies, certainly at Incisive and then latterly at Foundry particularly. We've always been challenged by our customers in that tech market to come up with new ideas, to deliver first, to, as I said in the previous question, to make sure that what we're doing measures back against, you know, ROI and so forth. So I think with that in mind, you have no real choice but to keep putting yourself up for challenges. And I think that requires a bit of personal push as well.
Yeah,
I've had lots of chances to get exposure to different projects and different areas of expertise. Yeah. I think working in working in the technology market where there's constant product development and lots of competition means inevitably you sort of have to stay on top of that curve. And we've got quite a collaborative culture here, quite a flat structure. So, you know, you need to push yourself forward to take advantage of that, of course. But I think working in a collection of industries that are constantly transforming, technology, media, marketing technology, that's great for self-development. And actually, I think customers drive us as much as we drive them. So I think if you're talking to customers, if you're in front of people, if you're listening to what their challenges are, then I think that really pushes you to stay current. And of course, make sure you're reading and you know, keeping abreast of developments. But I think I've been lucky that I've been able to try a lot of different things, and I guess by process of elimination, work out what I'm good at and home into what those are, and probably been moved away from the things I'm bad at by people who are cleverer than me as well. But, and I've been able to do that without moving around too much. So yeah.
Bit of luck, bit of hard work. That's typically the recipe.
Yeah.
So let me just take you back to your sort of, when you're thinking about getting your first role, because there's GCSEs, A-levels just come out, people just got degrees.
Yeah.
I've been speaking to a lot of grads, people working out.
Yeah.
Unless you've got a profession and you wait, you know, you knew from an early age you want to become a doctor or, you know, a vet. Mm. Lots of people do sort of vocational degrees and they're working out what to do. So I don't know about you, but I found my first job through my mum's hairdresser, not in hairdressing, bizarrely. Yeah. But my mum was sitting in the hairdressing chair, you know, what my son's just come from university with a history degree. Do you know anyone who can help? And he just happened to know someone that ran a big advertising agency, right? I had no desires to get into that, but I fell into it that way. How did you start your career? You know, how did you get your first job?
Yeah, very similar, actually. We're not related to a hairdresser. I've never had much need for hairdressers, but similar to you, I did an English literature degree, which doesn't really prepare you for any sort of vocational start, although it is. And I note that the English literature degrees are becoming less popular and less supported these days. I think that's a real shame, because actually a lot of those intangible skills that I've taken through my career came from from that degree. So I do think that's a real shame. And again, probably another whole podcast there. But I started my career 25 years ago in sales, and that definitely wasn't part of a grand plan at that stage. In fact, I'd say I probably got into what I'm doing now because I didn't understand what the letters OTE meant on a salary on a job. Yeah. So my first job was actually on a photography magazine, but then I guess I had an unwittingly pivotal moment in my life in 1999 when I got a job at a company called VNU, who are a technology publisher. And I described that as pivotal because since then I've been almost exclusively involved in the tech industry, VNU, Incisive, and now Foundry. And many of the people I work with there, I do feel very fortunate in this. Many of the people I work with there, I work with still now.
Sure.
Competitors, even customers. So it was a really good breeding ground for some very talented people, a proper powerhouse, and a really good place to work. So I think a little bit of luck, being in the right place at the right time, but also knowing, making sure you have connections with people and that you stay in touch with people. I think certainly early on in one's career, if that network is really important. If people build some trust with you, they'll look after you.
Yeah, and ever so more now. And also, we got more tools than we ever had. When we first came out of uni, there was no LinkedIn. There was none of this stuff. So we actually had to go out and meet people and sort of graft a bit. But you can now graft in different ways on social media. No, interesting. And I see from your sort of, from what you've done previously, that I guess like me, you bounce around. You have a few jobs to start off with, don't you? Mm-hmm. Just to see what you like, what you don't like. And then you sort of find a path. So you've been in your current role 8 years, and obviously you stayed 7 years in the previous role at Incisive. And there's lots of talk out on socials about, people just doing a bare minimum. They want to leave in roles and not quite sure what they're doing, the great resignation, all this sort of stuff. But obviously you've stuck with two companies for the best part of 15 years.
Yeah, and thankfully they stuck with me.
but obviously for a reason. How do you keep yourself? People are listening. What do you think the merits are of? Obviously, you've got to do good work, and you've got to enjoy what you do. But what's the merits? Because the grass always isn't always greener on the other side.
Hmm.
How do you keep yourself challenged? Or what the merits do you think of staying with one firm?
Yeah, I think something that I like to see out of anything that I do is being able to see how things improve and being able to see tangible results and. That can take time. So, I think an element of longevity allows you to actually, see things and watch them grow. And I think sometimes it's important when you've been somewhere for a while to actually stop and think about what you've achieved. Sometimes that can get lost in the day to day. And I feel lucky that I'm in a growing, progressive company with some talented and frankly some quite amusing people as well that I work with. I mean, I think building those personal relationships is always helpful as well. And I think in any role there's less glamorous aspects to the role. You're never going to get away from that. But I think if you've got context and if you've got that slightly longer view, you can understand why I'm doing this, how it contributes to the whole, what it will lead to, I think that's important. For me, I like, as I said, I like the idea that you have a particular mission and you have a particular purpose in what you're doing. And so that's something that I've been able to kind of see through longer term. Definitely really enjoy that.
Yeah, it makes sense. Okay, so we're going to talk a bit about Foundry.
Yes. Yeah.
So, which was formerly IDG.
Yeah.
And so I've had a little look through history, and there's a lot of companies that actually changed their name over the years. Various reasons. Most recently, Facebook have changed their name to Meta.
Indeed, yeah.
What's in a name change? Well, why did Foundry decide to move on from the IDG brand?
So it's important. I guess we're part of a bigger company. So IDG Inc. is still our overall parent company, and we have a sort of brother or sister company called IDC, which is our research arm. So IDG Communications was the media arm of IDG Inc., if you like. And
okay.
I think with the rebrand, it's worth thinking about what guided the change in our company. And I think we sort of said it right at the start, we moved from being a media events data and services company to being much more focused on marketing technology and data. And that doesn't mean that those media and events and data and services elements no longer exist. Of course they do, but it's a lot more than a cosmetic thing. We've actually been through quite a quiet revolution over the last couple of years. And I think the new brand really reflects that. When I think about the big driver of change in the last decade, and again, sort of touched on this before, I think it's around data. It's around the role of data. And when we to think about the core ethos of what we do, it's to generate data and it's to use and innovate with that data to drive demand for our customers. And our customers are overwhelmingly chief marketing officers in the tech industry, but increasingly chief revenue officers as well.
Yeah.
And they've got some really specific challenges. So they're challenged around access to and use of data. They're challenged around that sort of, you know, modern buzzword scale. They're challenged around building pipeline and getting leads into their CRMs. When they're selling into the end user companies that they sell to, there's really complex buying units that could be up to and probably more than 20 people involved in a tech, you know, enterprise purchasing decision. And there's a really, really fragmented and sort of wild market of suppliers out there as well. So it's a complex, complex world. It's far from simple for our customers. So one of the things that will help them is MarTech, you know, that can automate processes, it can give them analytics, it can build scale. But MarTech is less powerful without proprietary data. And we, from our sort of 50 years of heritage, we produce data constantly through our media properties, through the experiences that we build around them, and we gain insights from that. So we think that when we sort of start to look at what's the future for our company, we think that a media company without a viable tech stack who can't provide that ad tech and MarTech option to their customers doesn't have a future, because you can't offer the scale and the automation that our customers need. But similarly, MarTech companies without data and relationships are also weaker. So we're in quite an enviable position. We can deliver on both sides of that bargain. So we talk about and we test ourselves and sort of hold ourselves up to be at what we kind of call the intersection of media and marketing technology. And on top of that media and data background, which we had, to enable that and to speed that up and scale that up, we've made some really amazing acquisitions over the last couple of years.
Yeah, I've seen that. Yeah, tell us about those.
We've acquired four awesome companies. So we acquired Triblio, LeadSift, Kickfire, and Selling Simplified Group. So that's given us an ABM orchestration platform. It's given us the ability to track intent signals from across the web. It's given us the ability to identify website visitors, and it's given us a huge data stack and marketing as a service platform to drive our demand gen engine. And we've launched new products around that are focused on understanding audience intent, converting those intent signals to connections between buyers and sellers. But just to bring it back to the name change, against all of that progressive background, there was still a legacy perception of IDG Communications as a publisher network.
Right.
And you know, that's many, many great things within that, but people weren't aware of everything that we do. And we're really proud of that history. So the media bedrock is a big part of our future, but we repositioned because we wanted to highlight the unique kind of data and MarTech products and the change in our company. We've been releasing new products now for a long time around intent data. We've been growing our technology stack. So the change really underscores that transformation. It's much more than a cosmetic change, although the new logo is very cool. Sure. But it reflects the products that are transforming our business in the different ways that we're going to be working with customers.
Okay. Thank you. That was an excellent explanation.
Very good. If I can't do it, then there's a
yeah, very hangs together. So you're changing a name of a business, and also you're trying to convey the proposition that it now delivers and will deliver in the future. How do you go about, because you very succinctly said that to me, right? But you can't always do that in front of everybody, especially clients. So how do you broadcast that to firstly the wider world, and then we'll talk about internal at the moment. So what sort of challenges have you faced, and how have you overcome those?
Well, I think I guess there's two ways that you've got to look at that. There's the internal messaging, of course, to the people that work with us. And there's many people who've worked with us for many, many years. There's many people who we've hired in the last couple of years. There's probably different messaging for each of those sort of two groups. And then of course there's the external messaging. And as someone who's a relatively long time employee, I've definitely felt the challenge of suddenly needing to change what I used to say IDG 100 times a day for 8 years. So there's a challenge there. But I think internally, my point around the fact that this wasn't just cosmetic is relevant here, because all of our colleagues have seen the developments that we've been making take shape. It doesn't feel like the same company it was even a couple of years ago. And as a result, it feels actually quite natural to be talking about a new look, a new position, and a new name from a base of real positivity. Externally, I think it's a great opportunity for us to take control of the conversation a little bit too. I talked about the perception gap between what we do and what people maybe thought we did. And that differed every single individual we talked to, because we had such a long heritage. We have such a long heritage providing lots of different types of services. So people would maybe think of us as an events company or as a media company or as a data company, maybe not see the full gamut of what we did. So actually the name change and the rebrand conversation is a great opportunity for us to go out into the world and tell people why we've done that, what we do, and to introduce those new services to the client. And then I think there's a logistical element to that as well, and I can't claim any credit for this, but we had a really talented marketing and strategy team who thought a lot about the nuts and bolts of what would be needed, because it's a huge cultural shift. What would be needed in terms of branding, the website, social accounts, LinkedIn naming conventions, email signatures, contracts. We had a great FAQ document that we all had access to. We've all had some great training about the new brand. So it's something that the whole company can be excited about and buy into. And then if I can maybe just go on a little bit about the acquisitions and what that means to our sort of story and what we stand for, because where that's taking us is to that intersection point of media and MarTech. And what that means in real terms is that we want to own the sort of upper part of the sales pipeline. So all of our acquisitions, Triblio is a SaaS platform for account-based marketing. LeadShift is a sales and marketing intent intelligence platform. Kickfire is a marketing data and intelligence company. And Selling Simplified is a gigantic platform that gives lead generation products, data services, analytics. It means that we are now the world's biggest supplier of tech leads. And all those acquisitions have been around the goal of ensuring we can give marketers the tools to solve their challenges around data. It means they can be visible and interact with their customers and prospects. And all of these companies have added technology and development expertise to our media expertise. They've all got incredible founders and staff. They've got an entrepreneurial kind of startup culture, which maybe can be lacking in a 50-year-old media company. And they've significantly improved our sort of tech stack. So when you add all those elements together, we can use intent data to help marketers highlight accounts that show intent for their products. We can provide insights into the buying group at those companies. We can de-anonymize traffic on their site. We can cross-reference that against a huge database of first-party data based on genuine connections and interactions. We can offer an automation platform to talk to those people and connect with them with content. And we can wrap all of that around trusted, beloved media brands. And from there, we can offer you multiple ways to interact with those leads and nurture them. Media, events, content, demand gen. We can do that across the world, and we can report and analyze that as well. So our aim ultimately is to be a single supplier who our customers can trust to deliver that whole process for them against the background of a very confused market. So it's it really hangs together. It's gelling together. Of course, there's that's a journey. There's some twists and turns on that journey, but I feel really, really positive about the way that we're moving
there. Thank you. Sounds like definitely an exciting time. And as coming right back to the question, what's in a name change? Clearly, it's just not just a change of name.
You're almost sort of
my words, not yours, sort of relaunching a business to a certain extent, right? Because you're having to change all the processes and how you go about talking to your customers and what you're going to talk to them about. You mentioned, the value of brands and publicated community building. There's a lot of conversations around, in a podcast the other week, and the individual that I had on there was talking about, you know, it's difficult just to serve a community with one event, for example, right?
Yes. Yeah.
And obviously, you know, Foundry have a bunch of publications, you've got in-person events, you've got obviously all the new tools that you just mentioned, you've got virtual events.
Yeah.
So talk to me about the value of brands and how they sort of fit into building a community.
Oh, yeah. I mean, our brands are absolutely crucial to what we do. I think from its rawest point, we give our customers access to all of those media solutions which sit around our brands. That could be advertising, could be demand generation stuff, could be events, could be content creation. And key to all of that is the relationship with the audience. And I think our brands are really key to giving our audience the information they want, to building that trust with them, whatever format makes the best sense. And I think it's interesting with Foundry, we've always believed in having distinct brands to cover distinct technologies. So we have a lot of brands. We've never been a believer in the concept of having, you know, a portal where everybody comes through one door and then heads off to different chambers. We've always believed in distinct brands to cover distinct technologies and distinct audiences. So we have CIO, computer world, network world, info world, CSO, you know, very, very distinct brands. There's scarcity in some of those audiences, you know, but the point is that we're providing exactly the right content for those people. And I love the fact that people have grown up professionally with those brands. That's the key to our ability to to build communities and to grow relationships with those. And people maybe move between those brands, you know, as their career develops. It's a really exciting. I love the CIO, the chief information officer, and CSO, the chief security, the interaction between those two audiences is a really interesting one, quite different types of people. And there's a big conversation around, you know, whether CSOs, you know, can build themselves up to having a place on the board and you know, to moving into a CIO role, which is a wider, more strategic. So it's, you know, some really interesting dynamics between those brands, but we definitely think brands for audiences.
Sure, thank you. And you mentioned some roles there. You mentioned Chief Revenue Officer before as well.
Yeah.
And you know, a lot of these titles never existed. You know, Chief Data Officer never existed maybe 15 years ago.
Yeah.
And you know, the CTO probably did all of it. And now you've got the CTO and the CDO. Like, so you know, as a publisher, in that respect, and obviously a community builder, clearly it's important that you've got to keep ahead of the curve, right? And listen to your market on a continuous basis to understand, because you're serving the media that they're going to consume. So you have to be. How do you go about doing that?
I mean, we have journalists on the ground in every country that we operate in. I think that's a really important point to make. That in itself, you know, is real connections, real personal connections. The events business, which, you know, we talked about prices, the events business is absolutely key to that, bringing people together, of course, largely virtually over the last couple of years, but in face-to-face opportunities. I think we can surround people with different facets of content that will enable them to do their job. So that can be from, you know, celebratory awards style events to really in-depth, you know, white paper style content to webcasts to, you know, different formats, and of course the interaction that we have on social media with our audiences as well. So yeah, that, you know, to the previous point, the brands are absolutely pivotal to that. And I think having, you know, journalists in market on the ground is super important as well.
Sure. So you mentioned events, just want to touch upon that for a minute. Obviously, you know, we've been back in person, especially in the UK now, for some time. You know, I talk to lots of people and I run my own events, and there's certainly, you know, be some changes in the way that people, you know, both delegates and sponsors, you know, the demands around events. How have you guys found it? Because I know you launched a bunch of virtual events. And you're still launching some new virtual conferences. And I understand also that you launched some virtual events and they're now going physical. So just give us a flavour of the events division and how that's looking.
Yeah, I think to some degree, I've had a bit of an easier ride here than many on the events side of things. And the reason for that is that Foundry's got some gigantic events markets around the world, the US, Germany, Sweden, Asia. We've got some massive, massive events around the world. But for whatever reason, the UK, which is my sort of prime events market, we were never that big in events in the UK. And I'm not really 100% sure why, but But what it meant, I guess there was an element of luck for me there. As we came into the pandemic, we weren't sitting on a pile of face-to-face events, a really, really, you know, long-term calendar that we needed to protect and pivot. So for my group in the UK, and I would stress that's just the UK, I think other parts of the country had different challenges, but I can only speak to my experience. In the UK, we were able to move into virtual events very quickly and very easily, and actually being seen as digital experts through our sort of media side really helped there, as did the fact that we actually had made quite a conscious effort to double down on our investment on events. So we'd hired a great new events team, and we'd started to put more of a focus on events. So since 2020, the UK events business is actually, it's more than quadrupled in size for us in the UK. And while a lot of that growth was predicated on virtual formats, we're now building on that, and we're very much in the face-to-face space as well. I think virtual was a reaction to the pandemic, but it's actually provided benefits, which mean it won't go away. I do remember sort of 10, 15 years ago when there was a lot of talk about virtual events, you know, kind of wiping out face-to-face, and that was never gonna happen. But actually what we've seen with the more refined version that we've got now is it certainly enabled us to expand our audience. Our audience for the chief information officers in the UK is national. Of course, there are some concentrations in big urban areas, but chief information officers, IT directors, they're everywhere. And as well as that, they're time poor, they're on call. So the virtual format actually meant we could get more of them to attend our events. So for example, our CIO summit, which is a really strong event, probably had around 120 to 150 face-to-face attendees. We did over 500 virtually last year. And it also meant we could attract more diverse speakers. We were able to divert some of the budget that we would have had, speaking very honestly, some of the budget we would have had in venues into speakers. So we got a better number of speaker. But equally, I think there's certainly an appetite for a return to face-to-face. And we saw that faster from sponsors than delegates. And I think that's probably still the case. I think sponsors are still pushing it harder than delegates are. But for us, that just means we need to make sure that we offer a range of opportunities. So we're looking at our calendar now. We've got face-to-face and virtual opportunities. We've seen some great uptake for custom face-to-face events, for awards events this year. Yeah. And I think, though, we kind of serendipitously, due to the pandemic, we've actually found some new options and some new formats that we can build on. So, you know, there's been a lot of positive developments there, obviously from a negative situation to begin with.
Yeah, I mean, as we know, you know, virtual, excellent to deliver content, not so good to deliver, I mean, obviously delivering data, yes, but not sort of solid connections. And as we know, can't replicate the serendipitous moment of bumping into somebody, however small the conference is, big.
Absolutely. I think you've got to be really careful not to simply try and recreate physical in virtual. And that's probably a trap that a lot of people, us included, fell into right at the start of that. And I've actually been really impressed by the work that a lot of the virtual platforms have done to sort of hone the experience. I think that virtual conferences, as you say, are a great way of providing content, but there's struggles with that one-to-one human contact element of events for obvious reasons. But I think virtual lends itself really well to very content-heavy agendas, which suits our audience. I definitely like it as a conference format. I definitely won't miss the kind of enforced virtual awards that we ran a few times in the pandemic. But I think definitely we're moving some of our now established virtual events to physical. So, for example, our CIO Summit and our Security Summit next year, which are both real juggernauts, they're going to be physical events next year, and we're really looking forward to that.
Yeah.
I think in virtual, one tactic that's really become important for single sponsor events and multi-sponsor events is the role of the host or the moderator, the MC. I think that's really come into relief for me. I think that person is pivotal at creating those interactions that maybe wouldn't happen virtually. Yeah. But our belief has always been in virtual, you've got to promise more delegates, a bigger pipeline for sponsors. And that for sponsors, I think that's how we see the range of virtual and physical events that we offer. Sure. It's probably going to be different audiences. So it's about making sure you get the most people into your sales pipeline. We offer a spread of opportunities across the year for delegates and sponsors to experience different formats, different connections. And for delegates, what's never changed is the value of great content. So we won't stop investing in content now. We've hired a fantastic conference producer. We're building that team out. We're delivering some brilliant speakers and challenging, thought-provoking agendas. You can't just rely on people coming through the door. You've got to pull them in.
Yeah. Well, even more so, as you say, time poor, and because I guess the double-edged sword of virtual delivery of content is that people think, well, I can just get it virtually. I don't need to attend.
Yeah.
When they do get there, they realise the benefits of attending. So we do need to work
on. You know, one of the things I mentioned in some of the MarTech stuff is intent signals as well. I think is really important there. The fact that with a virtual event, you can actually pinpoint that this person attended these sessions, not every session maybe, but these sessions. Well, actually, I think there's still value in that. You can start to build a picture of what that person's interests are. And of course, as a sponsor, tailor how you respond to that and how you follow that lead up. So I think there's still positives that come out of that. Of course, you know, you want people to consume as much content as possible, but actually there's signals that you can pick up if people are picking and choosing as well.
Sure. And obviously there's a plethora of event tech out there that can allow us to do that as well, right? You know, yeah. I think they're definitely honing their propositions for, you know, return to in-person events. Yeah. Thank you for that. I just want to sort of move on to talent acquisition. And you mentioned that you've hired a few people.
Yeah.
Again, at certain levels, you know, you can only go onto social, specifically LinkedIn, and see people are trying to recruit for the same roles in a lot of similar industries. What do you think we can do as an industry to attract new talent? And I know that, you know, Foundry, in your role specifically, you span across, I guess, you know, marketing, tech, creative, publishing, and so on, and events. What's your view? What do we think we need to be doing more of to attract new talent to the industries that you represent?
Yeah, it's a really good question. I think the last couple of years, I think, has tested everybody, you know, and ultimately, I think most of the good stuff that's come out of that boils down to kind of humanity and empathy. So I think in terms of, you know, talent retention, I think as a leader, people want to feel personally invested in the company where they work. So having a clear ethos is important. It's a big part of any manager's role to make people's work meaningful. I think within that, there's feedback and context. I think that can be easily forgotten, particularly when you're managing remote teams, but it's really important. Yeah. Why am I doing this? How am I doing it? What's the result of it? How can I do it better? So I think clarity of expectation means people can see a pathway forwards. And of course, it's important to build a culture where people can thrive and they're trusted and empowered. I think in terms of attraction into the company and into the market, we've clearly been through some seismic changes, but ultimately, I still think there's a fair bit of common sense here. I think there's a lot that's been said about the effects of the pandemic on the world of work. I'm sure we haven't seen the full shakeout of that yet either. Yeah. But one of the big questions, of course, is around, you know, on-premise or remote work. I haven't seen people who are necessarily set on only one way of working. I think most of us have been quite fortunate to see our options for how we work open up immensely in the last few years. But what I do see and what I do think people need to see in terms of talent attraction is a company is going to make their job as doable as possible. There are, as you say on the event, so there's a lot of tools available. So there isn't one thing that plays into that, but it's having the right technology, the right systems, the right blend of skills and culture. You know, I think people absolutely want to see a company that stands for something, having respect for one another, having a clear idea of what we're trying to do and everybody pulling together on that. So our rebrand's been important to that.
Yeah.
And it's meant that we...
Yeah. Yeah,
you know, we can state and message what our goals are and what we stand for. Certainly flexible working is really important. We were always pretty good at that, to be honest, even pre-pandemic. But of course, that's come into real focus afterwards. We're focused on making sure that we cast that recruitment net wide as well, offer opportunities to all our staff. And, you know, we need new voices. Right at the start, we both talked about how we ended up in this largely by accident. And I think one of the best things I've worked on in the last couple of years is our intern program, which we run in association with London South Bank University. And that's meant we can bring in and we can meet candidates who may not have known a company like ours existed. And we've seen some really talented new recruits coming through that, some great intellects.
What is that period of time that people get to work at different parts of the business?
That's it. Yeah, exactly. And we run both an internship program where we rotate people pretty quickly through three or four departments in a month. We also have a placement scheme, which is longer, for 8 or 9 months, where we take students who are kind of midway through their degrees and give them that real world experience. And, you know, the other thing I would always say to everybody around internships, for God's sake, make them paid. You know, it's the unpaid internship is a completely unfair and unbalanced thing. We would never do that. Yeah.
So, to be fair, I think most of the internships I've seen displayed are paid. I think people now, yeah, the days of trying to get cheap free labour and dressing it up as an internship, you're going to get found out.
That's it. I mean, you know, someone said to me a while ago, one of my teammates said, you know, talent is everywhere, but opportunity isn't. And that's a perfect example where, you know, you're forcing somebody into making a decision that ultimately, you know, limits their options in life. So, yeah, I think it's really important that we cast our net wide and we're listening to what people are looking for. But it's, you know, it's a very competitive market out there at the moment. Sure. And, you know, I think as well as pay, benefits is really important as well. You know, making sure that you know, other parts of people's lives are taken care of and considered in that process as well. The final thing I'd say on recruitment as well, is something I've learned, is the speed of the process in a competitive market. You know, you've got to be careful dragging people through, you know, four or five interviews that are maybe a week apart. You know, it's people are moving quickly, and so, you know, you need, as an employer, you need to show that that motivation and that desire as much as an employee does as well.
Yeah, I think there needs to be a balance, right? You don't want to do it too quickly that you haven't, both parties haven't understood what the role is, and then someone turns up and goes, "Oh, I didn't realise it was this."
Yeah,
but yeah, you're absolutely right. The people that are coming in, you know, you need to try and get them in as quickly and as reasonably as possible. Yeah. Okay, so just me to you now. I think we've covered pretty much most of the things. Is there anything else before I sort of ask you the last desert island question? Anything else that you feel we've missed that you want to cover? But I think we've sort of touched upon quite a bit. We've done the role of foundry, events, value of brands.
Yeah, no, it's really good.
You're a very good speaker, by the way. I could listen to you.
I hope it's just interesting.
No, it's good. It makes sense. I was listening intently. Cool. So I'm going to just ask you the final question, which I sort of added at the end. I used to ask them and I stopped, but I'll do it again. So have you had a think about a couple of people? Yeah,
I have. Yeah.
So, Jim, sadly, we're coming to the end of our discussion. I'd like to ask some of my guests this final question. So if you were on unfortunately, let's say you'd been on an industry booze cruise in the middle of the ocean. And which went a little bit wrong, and you got washed up on a desert island with some of the people that are on the boat.
Right.
Which two people from within your sort of sphere of your professional life would you be okay stranded on the island with, and give me the reasons?
Oh, well, that's a tough, and I have to be there, do I? I have to be there with them.
Well, unless you've escaped without them. You've got to be there with them, yeah. You've got to be there with them.
Okay, so I would bring, on the basis that I have to be there as well, I would bring firstly, I would bring Jonathan Collins from Jonathan Collins Associates, and formerly of VNU and UBM, among other places. And the reason I would bring Jonathan is he's been a really good mentor and friend to me, but he's got some serious sartorial elegance. So I feel like if there's anybody in my sphere that I know who would have a desert island capsule wardrobe ready to go, it would probably be JC, and maybe he'd share it with me to keep the sun off my back. Also, he's given me some great advice over the years, kept me on the straight and narrow a few times, so I think that would be useful in what potentially is a life or death situation. And then building on that kind of life or death situation element, and this will sound quite obsequious, but I would probably bring my boss, who is a chap called Neil Michael. And the primary reason why I would bring Neil is actually because he quite frequently provides me with unsolicited health and survival advice. So now often that relates to building physical resilience through diet, but I'd actually like to see that put to the test in a true wilderness environment rather than in zone one of London. So that's that would be my desert island crew. I'm already starting to have second thoughts, but I think that would be my... That's my desert island crew. Hopefully we won't be there for long and we'll get
sponsored. Yeah, you get rescued. Perfect.
Anchor or something, but yeah.
Jim McGinty, MD and Foundry of Western Europe, thank you so much for your time today. Really fascinating insight into you as an individual, your career to date, the market, and Foundry. And it looks like there's some, you know, the Foundry business is going from strength to strength, and we wish you all the best for the future.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate it. It's been great talking to you. Thank you.
Cool. Good. Awesome. Hope that was all right.